Well, we have been studying Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He leads me to green pastures and quiet waters. And we've been talking about these things here in the last couple of lessons. And now we're going to be talking about restoration, because that's really what the next verse talks about there in Psalm chapter 23 and verse 3, it says, He restores my soul, He guides me in the paths of righteousness for His name's sake. When someone leaves the Lord and then they return, we call that restoration. And the reason why we call it that is because they've been restored to a status, for lack of a better term, that they once had but went away from. They've been restored to their former relationship with God and hopefully with us as well. And that's a time for rejoicing. It's a time for celebration. In fact, in Luke chapter 15, verse 7, I'll just cite it there for you. You see there that Jesus is talking about the shepherd who had 100 sheep and one goes astray and then he finds it and brings it back. And what does he say? Well, back to the old shepherding routine, right? That's not what he says. He's rejoicing, and then he calls his friends together and says, Rejoice with me, I've found my sheep that was lost. So God looks at restoration as a time for celebration, and so should we. There's two ways to look at restoration. There's subjective and objective. By subjective, I mean we're looking at the individual person being restored, and that person may be you. Okay? We're looking at a person being restored to their spiritual health, so to speak. Or objectively is when the flock itself, whether a congregation or the brotherhood, is restored to its former number or to whatever number it had attained at some point in time. And when the part of the whole is missing, well, then the whole is not whole. It's incomplete. It's less than perfect or less than what it should be. And if that missing part never returns, well, then eventually there's an acceptance of that lost person and a redefinition of what the whole is. Now, I'm just throwing out some basic concepts here because we go through this practically throughout our history as a congregation. This is what we have done. Members have come on board, if you will. They have been baptized or they have moved from other places and they've said, we want to be members here. And then sometimes what happens is they stop coming or they want to do other things or they just don't want to serve the Lord anymore. And so we try to restore them. And when that fails, if it fails, well, then we redefine who we are once again without that person. Not by our choice, but simply by necessity. But restoration is really what we're after. In all forms of discipline, whether it's instructive or corrective or even punitive, in all forms of church discipline, restoration is the goal. That's what we're after, is to constantly restore us to the right relationship that we have with God. All right, that's a lot of preamble there, but it helps us to understand where this lesson is going. And you have to ask the question in what David says in Psalm 23:3, was David spiritually lost? Is that what he's talking about? Has he fallen away from the faith or from the law of Moses or from God himself? Is he referring to an erring brother? Or is it possible that David refers to his being separated from the shepherd because of his own sin? And his life is worn down and depleted because of that sin. We do have other passages, Psalm 32 and Psalm 51, for example, where he comes out and says that. Or, in any case, it may be that he's simply being worn down from the daily grind of life itself, dealing with sin, whether his own or someone else's, the troubles of life, the troubles of being a king, the troubles of being a person. Okay? There's just a lot of struggle out there. But nonetheless, restoration is the goal. It is the objective. And David realizes that he cannot accomplish that process on his own, nor was he supposed to. David credits or defers to the source of his restoration and his refreshment. It is Jehovah. It is the Lord himself. The Lord is my shepherd. He is the one who restores me, is really what he's saying. So I want to ask up front, you think about these questions here. What is your source of strength? What is your source of restoration? And are you tired and weary? And do you feel like you're carrying a heavy burden on your shoulders? And are you wearied with just the daily grind of life itself? And what are you doing about that? And how are you letting that affect you, or are you? Where do you find your restoration? Where do you find your refreshment and the rest for your soul? Where do you find all that? It's not in a church building. I'm just going to give you that up front. That's not where you find it. This is where we come to learn about these things. This is not where we come to be fulfilled. Okay? We are fulfilled in a different way, and I hope the lesson brings that out. All right. So I don't want to get into all word studies and all, and I'm not a Hebrew scholar, and I don't pretend to be, nor do I even want to be. There are other people who are in that profession, and I learn from them as I need to. Okay? But in Hebrew, the word restore has many different translations in English. In fact, looking it up on Strong's dictionary there, just the list has kept going on and on and on about how many different ways this Hebrew word can be translated here. But in its general sense and its most common sense, it means literally to turn back, not necessarily to a starting point, but to a direction. What I mean by that is it doesn't mean go all the way back to exactly where you started, but it means go back to where you should be. It's a directive idea, not a go back to the point of origin idea. So it indicates redirection and a recalling or a recovering or a refreshing or a relieving. It indicates all of those things. And it implies, because of those things, a restoration. This is not such a hard thing. When you're driving down the road, you are constantly restoring your steering, right? Your direction. If you were to take your hands off the wheel, pretty soon you'd end up in the other lane or in a ditch. Okay, or off the bridge, or wherever you're traveling, that would happen because your car just doesn't go all by itself in a straight line. You're constantly restoring or, you know, redirecting that car by reconfiguring the steering wheel. And the same thing when you bring a car to an original, what we call an original condition. Of course, it's not the original car. In the sense of how it was when you first started, because you've done all these repairs and jobs of restoration, but it's called a restoration job nonetheless. Or when your computer gets messed up, you might notice that there's a thing on your Windows programming there that offers you a restore point. And it doesn't mean it goes back to when the computer was first programmed. It means it brings it back to where it should be when it was working properly, before it got messed up, which is why you're doing the restore point, okay? Maybe some of you know what I'm talking about. I speak from experience. All right, so that's just gives some ideas of what we're talking about, going back to the right direction. Well, sheep, like people, like to stray and they like to wander. A lot of animals do. And it's a shepherd's job to keep their eye on their sheep and to rescue them if they are lost, or search for them if they go astray there. And what do sheep like? Well, the same thing people like. They're attracted to other pastures. You say, I don't like other pastures. Well, we're using this metaphorically, okay? So fill in the blank. Whatever your pasture is that you like other than what you have, the lure of something better on the other side. And when we say better, we're being very subjective. We're saying seemingly better, but maybe not, right? Or sheep are butted out by dominant sheep, if you can imagine such a thing. Dominant sheep, it just seems kind of silly to me. But anyway, in a sheep's world, there are inferior and superior animals and dominant sheep and not so dominant. And when there's too much agitation and anxiety within the flock, well, then they tend to go away from that, just like people do, right? Because people love to be in the midst of conflict and anxiety and turmoil. No, they don't like that. And a lot of times people leave whatever they're in to avoid that. Or sheep can be scattered by predators. A sheep's only defense, really, is to run away. And they don't always run in the right direction. So they really don't have a defense, so to speak, as we mentioned last lesson. And so people also are scattered by predators. There are people who want to destroy other people, take advantage of them, exploit them, right? Capitalize on their weaknesses. We see that. Or the simple lack of attention, not paying attention to where you're going, drifting off without realizing it. Sheep are pretty dumb animals. Everyone who is a shepherd says that. They're dumb animals, okay? And I'm not trying to say people are dumb, but sometimes people, even though they're intelligent beings, do dumb things. Like not pay attention when they're supposed to. Right? So what David is saying here, what he's implying in what he's saying, is very important for us. And David realized that just as sheep, so people are susceptible to all those things. And it demands the oversight of the shepherd to redirect the sheep, or in the case of people, to where they need to be. And so it says there that he guides me in paths of righteousness. And that's one of the things that the shepherd is supposed to do. That word path there can also be translated track or way. Okay, the tracks of righteousness or the ways of righteousness. And I don't want you to think of paths here as being plural, as in, implying that there's many routes to heaven. You know, we're not talking pluralism here, which is an actual idea, philosophy of men. He's not talking about that. What we're trying to do is say that there is a path of righteousness, and whatever it is for a sheep that leads to where that sheep needs to be, the shepherd is going to guide him there. Okay? And so there's an idea that is not separate here from what he's been talking about. He restores my soul. How does he do that? By leading me to where I need to go. By bringing me back to where I need to be. That's how he does that. That is the objective. The path is where you ought to be, but to get there, you have to be restored. And so the restoration process is necessary in order for you to get to that place. So David sees himself or others losing direction, out of the path, out of the track, out of the way, getting into a foreign or unknown path where there is danger, obviously, and a lot of potential ruin. And he recognizes Jehovah as the shepherd, the one who is guiding a person or himself, not back to his original point where he was when he was innocent in his youth, okay, forgetting all that he learned and going back before he was ever educated. It's not that, but rather guiding him to where he needs to be, something from which he has left, okay? And that's really what is going on here. So God doesn't just sit back and watch us crash and burn, I guess is one of the things you want to get out of this. He's very interested in our spiritual well-being, and he restores us. You say, how does he do that? Well, I'm not going to go into all the depth of this here, but you know that through his word and through his spirit are two things, really one and the same thing, if you think about it, because the spirit has revealed the word. So he restores us through the written word. He restores us through the guidance of his spirit. He restores us also through discipline, if that is needed. Those who I love, I discipline. That's out of Revelation 3:19 that you see on the screen there. And that's Jesus saying that. So I know that it's a good source. And I know that what he's saying is in our best interest, even though we don't like discipline. But that may be necessary for the restoration process. And of course, he restores people through the counsel of more spiritual-minded people or more grounded people or more mature people as well. Is there anything wrong with that? No. We need each other for that very thing. We need to be restored sometimes. We need that counsel and that advice. Yes, even the admonition of spiritual people. All right, so that talks about the word restore. Now we want to talk about the word soul here. He restores my soul. And that word in Hebrew is a generic word, which means any living or breathing animal or person or being. And it refers generally or generically to vitality, appetite, or breath. Again, we don't have to be word experts. That's not my point. But we do want to have a general sense of what's going on here. The implication here is that what is being restored is one's source of strength, his physical and mental body. The whole person is being restored, okay? And that doesn't mean to perfect health. Like the only way that you can be restored is to gain back all of your youthful vitality and so on. But it's just looking at you as a whole person, okay? And it's taking into account your whole being there. If your spiritual life is deteriorated and worn and depleted, that has a direct connection to your physical life and your physical attitude. Your whole being, in other words, is being affected. Have you ever experienced that? When your spirits are down, so to speak, doesn't that have an effect on how you think? And doesn't that also have an effect on your emotions? And also an effect, even possibly, on your physical well-being? It does. I speak, again, from experience, and I'm sure many of us could testify to the same thing. Obviously, a healthy spiritual life leads to a better life altogether, mentally, emotionally, even physically. It's a well-rounded life. And we can see the same thing in the opposite direction, that a spiritually deficient life, a spiritually unhealthy life, can have a detrimental effect on your mental state, on your emotional state, yes, even on your physical state. Some people refuse to see this, even though they are living proverbs of the very thing. They allow their spiritual life to languish and falter and become undernourished, and they think that otherwise they're okay. See, I'm healthy. Physically, I'm okay. Nothing's happened to me. And people get this misconception, like, hey, I can stay away from the church, and I don't have to read my Bible, and I don't have to pray to God, and lightning didn't come down, and the ground didn't open up, and life seems to be going on pretty much like it did before, so why did I ever need to do those things, and it's okay if I don't? And they start reasoning that way, because they don't realize that what is happening to them is happening gradually and not immediately. Because I guarantee you that if a person keeps with that type of thinking, and if you watch them over a year, and then 5 years, and then 10 years, you're not going to see them improving. You're going to see them degrading. And that degrading is not going to be limited just to their Bible knowledge, okay? Although that too. But it's going to have an effect on their mental well-being, their emotional well-being, and possibly, yes, even their physical well-being. Now, we don't want to put this to the test, although we could point out examples if we needed to. In other words, we don't have to look very far to see the effects of this. It's not uncommon among those who actually abandon the Lord to encounter very serious health problems and very serious emotional instability and mental anguish. Some of these people end up in the psychiatric wards. Some of them commit suicide. I have seen this happen among those who used to be Christians. Ah, they're still Christians technically, but they simply aren't living as Christians. And this is what happens to them sometimes. Someone says, well, that's never going to happen to me. Well, why is that? It's because you're a church member? Because you're a part of some group of a sound congregation? Is that what it is? Or is it because the Lord is your shepherd, and you shall not want any other Lord? And you go where he leads you, to green pastures, and you drink what he offers you, quiet waters, and you allow him to restore your soul. Is that what it's all about? I guarantee it is, if indeed you're doing it rightly. That's where it's all at, right? So David recognizes the shepherd is directly involved, directly responsible for restoration, replenishment of the whole person. Just going to church or sitting through a service, this is not going to do this for you. And I don't mean to discourage you from being here. I know the elders or other people might be going, oh, don't say that. You know, like we're giving permission for you to leave. That's not what we're doing at all. In fact, I'm actually enforcing the behavior that we're doing here. I'm saying that this is good and healthy. What I'm saying, though, at the same time is this is not your final objective, being here this morning. This is a route to that objective. And I hope that you see that. All right, so let's shift gears a little bit in our lesson here and say just up front that it's typical for people to make something good that is given by God into something harder and more difficult than was ever imagined. I don't know if you've ever seen this happen before. Yes, you have. Okay, I'm just going to tell you. You have seen this before, and perhaps you have participated in it yourself, okay? I'm just going to cite some examples here in the Bible. The law of Moses, for example, was given as something that was good. That's what it was intended for. But the Jews had a way of turning it into something oppressive and legalistic, and they robbed the law of the joy and the opportunity that a person had to understand God and his holiness. And by doing so, they also robbed a person of the mercy and the grace of God, not that came from law, so to speak, but that certainly was talked about in that law and was offered through the law in the sacrificial system. So they robbed the person of all that and just said, this is the law. Keep the law. And we're going to tell you not only the law to keep, but we're going to put a hedge around the law of all these other things that you need to do. And they turned it into a oppressive thing. I know that never happens today in religion, but just pretend that you understand, you know, that that could happen in the ancient past. Circumcision, not a big topic today, I understand that, but it was because it was a sign of the covenant. And the Jews took that a little bit too seriously in the sense that they thought it was really the sign that they were better people than everyone else on the face of the earth, morally superior because of this act. And so what they turned the sign of the covenant into was a sign of controversy and a sign of contention and a sign of division and a sign of self-righteousness. And they corrupted that beautiful idea that is in the sign of the covenant. And we could talk about the Sabbath as well, which was intended as a time of rest, even a time of celebration. That's how God instituted it. That's what he said about it. The Jews turned it into a mockery of rules and regulations and strict formalities. There are 39 Jewish laws at the time of Christ, 39 commandments that the Jews added to the ordinance of the Sabbath to keep people from breaking the Sabbath. So, not only do you need to observe the Sabbath, but you've got 39 other laws that you need to keep. Judaism, legalism, is very similar today, wrestling over words and opinions and issues. People are not always concerned with where people stand with the Lord or the right relationship or even restoration. Rather, it comes down to whose side are you on? And is it possible that we, when we do that, we turn Christianity, something that was intended for good, into something complicated, something overwhelming, and something that is oppressive? Do we, in the Brotherhood, rob the gospel of its immediate benefits and its spiritual value and its restorative qualities? Do we do that? I mean, you know, it's a good question to ask ourselves. Not a comfortable question, but it's a good question. It's a healthy question. Do we turn it into a bunch of do's and don'ts? Believe this and don't believe that. Defend this side, destroy that side. Liberal, conservative. Is that what we turn it into? Which camp are you in? I will say, as a side note, that the last 50 years, the church has wasted a tremendous amount of time and energy talking about, arguing over, dividing over the issues. And in the process, we have lost a lot of souls. Souls that could have been taught if we had just focused on what we should have, and could have been taught if we had just gotten away from the controversy and started focusing on our mission, which, by the way, is discipleship, not which camp are you in. I'm not saying that there isn't a time to defend what is true and to defend it tenaciously. I'm not saying that there isn't a time for that. I'm saying that we can't sacrifice our mission as Christians in the process. We just can't do that. Jesus didn't give the gospel to us to beat over the heads of other people or to pound people into submission or to argue over or to divide over or to draw lines in the sand over. At the same time, now it sounds like, you know, I'm just beating on us here, and at the same time we see in the religious world going the opposite direction in the other extreme there, and this is much of modern Christianity, which basically says it doesn't matter what you believe, and it doesn't matter who teaches what. What just matters is that you love God, be a good person, forgive everybody of anything, no matter what. That's baloney too, by itself. Not that we shouldn't love God and not that we shouldn't be good and so on, but it's the context in which that is placed, at the exclusion of God's commandments or to the exception of those things. And that's just as much a misrepresentation of the gospel as it would be of legalistic, Pharisaic system that we see in the New Testament, that judgmentalism that we see among the Pharisees. It's just a different kind of oppression. Ignorance of the Bible is a form of oppression. I have much to say about that. I'm going to save it for another lesson, but I will talk about that because people don't realize it. It is just as destructive as beating people over the head with the gospel. And I don't think we always see that. Or maybe we don't think about that. Maybe we all think we're just doing what's necessary and what's right, and therefore that justifies how we're doing it. There's a lot to think about here, isn't there? You say, what does this all have to do with restoration? Well, because we need to know to what are we being restored. There is a right way, but it's not your way. And it's not my way. It's God's way. Okay? The paths of righteousness means that there is a right way in which to live, which also necessitates that there's a wrong way in which to live. But it's not you that decides that for yourself or anyone else. It is God that has to decide that. It's God who's saying that in the first place. The gospel is the means to restore souls and lives through the direct guardianship, oversight, and resources of the shepherd. It's not just something to make our souls feel better, like we're trying to jack someone's spirits up or trying to improve their self-esteem. We're trying to teach them through their own study and their own application how they can be transformed through the power that God provides when they study and when they put forward that effort. I'm not saying we're just plugging into God, and I hear that sometimes from people, and I think that misrepresents the idea. You know, like God is a source of energy and we plug into him and we get energy for ourselves to do what we need. I don't think that's accurate. I think what it is that we're standing in the presence of God and that energy is all around us and fills us up. But you've got to be with God in order to do that. Not just plugged in, but you need to have fellowship with him in order for that to happen, for that to be successful. Jesus himself says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me. There is no other path of righteousness than Christ, and no one can restore a person's soul like Jesus alone can do. If Jesus is not leading the soul, then that person cannot end up in the path of righteousness. There's no person or philosophy or religion or psychology that can replace what he does himself. You can't take the shepherd out of the picture and put in anything else and make it work. If you take the shepherd out of the picture, and there is only one shepherd, then the picture fails altogether. There is no picture. If a person's soul is not managed by Christ through the gospel, and not that person himself, then it's not managed properly at all. Let me make that more pointed. If your soul is not being managed by Christ, then your soul is not being managed at all. You say, well, that's not true. I'm managing it. My point exactly. It's not being managed at all. Because whatever you're doing or whatever you're allowing someone else to do or some other teaching to do is leading straight to your destruction. And there's nothing else that you can do about that except to leave that path and be restored to the path of righteousness. You can't close your eyes and make it go away, although many people try. Here's some things that you can do that I have discovered, not personally through my experience, but I've watched people. You can refuse to pay your taxes. If there were a war, you could dodge the draft. You could quit your job. You can desert your family. You can disappear into the mountains, and you can forfeit all responsibility on earth. But here's something that you cannot do. You cannot ever evade your responsibility to God successfully, because you're going to die and leave this earth, and you're going to stand before him. And there's nothing that you can do about that. There's no way that you can avoid that. And you would do well then to prepare for that, as we've been advocating in our last several weeks of lessons. Jesus offers restoration through divine liberation, freedom from hopelessness. I'd like you to turn now to Matthew chapter 11, verse 28 through 30, because I think a good way to explain Psalm 23, verse 3, is to go to something we're more familiar with and then recognize that this, what we're more familiar with, is talking about that. But the two things are not two separate teachings at all. They're really saying the same thing. Look at Matthew 11, verse 28 through 30. It says, come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. I want you to just think about this as a parallel to what we've been reading here this morning. First of all, Jesus says, come to me. And the reason he says that is because he and he alone can help. He doesn't say, come to preachers, or come to me as a preacher, or come to the elders, or come to church, or come to religion. That's not what he's saying here. In the context, he's talking about salvation. I can't save you. You can come to me or come to my house all you want to, but you're still in your same spiritual condition as when you came or before you came. I'm not going to change that by myself, but the shepherd can. The shepherd has that power. He has that authority to change your situation. And so he says, come to me. And maybe you're weary and heavy laden. Maybe you understand what that means. You experience that personally. We are weary sometimes through our own self-made yokes that are too heavy and too hard to bear. Hopefully everyone understands what a yoke is. I know we're not a bunch of agrarian people now, so we're not out there putting the yoke on the cattle anymore. I don't think, anyway. Maybe you are. Yoke is simply a harness, a wooden harness that has one place for one cow's head to go in, and then it has another harness on the other end of the harness, another opening rather, on the other end of the harness there for another cow, so that the two animals can work in tandem, or I should say side by side here. They can work together. And you can have multiple yokes where you can have a whole team working together. But in this particular case, what Jesus is really saying is, we need to work together for your salvation. Because Jesus isn't going to do it by himself, and you certainly aren't going to do it without him. And I can guarantee you, he's going to pull the heavier part of the load, but you're going to be right there with him, so to speak, right? I mean, we're just kind of using that analogy. Sometimes we make our own yokes, and that is too hard to bear. We yoke up, so to speak, with someone or something that is far more difficult than what Jesus says to do. And it leads to our destruction. For example, we are yoked with guilt and sin. And that leads to our destruction, as you know. John 8, verse 34, Jesus says that anyone who sins becomes a slave of sin. We yoke up, so to speak, with sin. And God cannot restore the soul. He cannot refresh your life without first dealing with the sin. Isn't it amazing that sometimes people want to become Christians or become a member of a church or enjoy all the benefits that a congregation has to offer, but they don't want to take care of their sin? You've got to start in the starting place. You've got to deal with what is most important up front. And dealing with sin is the most important thing. If you were to look back in the Law of Moses and look at the three sacrificial groups, you've got sin offerings, burnt offerings, and free will offerings. You can't perform a consecratory burnt offering until you take care of the sins. And you most certainly cannot offer a free will offering if you haven't taken care of your sins. So what do you have to do? The first in order is always the sin offering. The reason for that, obviously, is because you can't have fellowship and deepen that fellowship with God until you take care of that which separated you from him in the first place. The sin has got to be addressed. And self-righteousness is another yoke that we wear sometimes. We establish a pattern or a law for ourselves, and then we break it. And when we break it, we have no redemption from it. We have no recourse. There's nothing we can do. For example, say you say for yourself, I believe personally it is wrong to lie, regardless of what God says about it, but I believe that it is profoundly wrong for a person to lie. And so I'm going to judge people by whether they are liars or not, but I'm also going to judge myself. And then you go down the road of life a little bit, and you find yourself telling a lie. You just broke your own law. The problem with doing that is that now you have used this standard of righteousness for yourself and you broke it and there is no redemption from it. You can't fix that. Once it's broken, you can't fix that. So now you're no longer a law keeper. Now you are a law breaker. And you're going to go from this point forward as a law breaker. That's self-righteousness and the futility of self-righteousness. That you can't even live up to your own law. And people oppress themselves with that. And of course, there's fear of the future, fear of the judgment to come, fear of the criticism of other people. Certainly, that's a big thing. Fear of the inability to perform or not meeting people's expectations. And there's sometimes other people's problems that we yoke up with or wear as a burden to ourselves. Other people's problems, other people's opinions, other people's judgments, other people's values, their beliefs, their doctrines. And you see this a lot in families, you know, where the kids are being brought up and you know, mom or dad's doctrine has been force-fed into them, and they feel like that this is a yoke that they have to bear, and whether that doctrine was right or wrong, they feel like that this is an oppression. Because it's not their own conviction, it's someone else's. And these become very heavy burdens for people to bear. That's why Jesus says, if you feel weary and heavy laden, you need to come to me for rest. Take my yoke, he says, which is manageable and bearable. And it doesn't crush you. It strengthens you. The effort that you use to exert yourself in that yoke is not going to be resulting in your destruction. It's going to result in a better character, a more mature person, a more spiritual person. And it is easy by comparison. 1 John chapter 5, verse 3, John says there that his commandments are not burdensome. Jesus never meant to overwhelm us with commandments. That's not their objective. And if you make them that objective, then you are misrepresenting Christ. What he's implying in all this, too, is that I'll take your yoke, that one that you used, that one that you put on yourself that is destroying you, give that to me. Okay, that's right. In the process, that's what Jesus is saying. Let me have that. And you say, well, what's he going to do with it? Don't worry about it. I'm sure he's going to consign it to the fires because it's useless. All right, but the point is that he's saying, give me that yoke of yours that is worthless and going to destroy you. Take this yoke instead. This is something manageable and you can do this. And I'll be right there next to you all the time. He doesn't ask you for what you cannot give. Don't ever say, well, this yoke means a lot to me. I don't think I can give it up. This yoke has been with me for the last 20 years. It's just a part of my identity. Well, you need to lose that part of your identity. Because in becoming a Christian and living as a genuine Christian, you forfeit all other identity anyway. So think about what's being said here. He asks us to give him our troubles and our problems and our stress and our heartache and our sinful lives. He's asking for you to give that to him. And what does he give you in return? Mercy and grace and, Micah, patience and forgiveness and all of the things that you need, the tools that you need to become a transformed person. That's what he gives you in return. We've lumped that into the big picture of grace there. Grace is anything and everything that he gives to you that you could not have for yourself, but which is necessary for your salvation. That's what grace is. And that's what he gives to you. You know what's amazing to me is that Satan's yoke drives people into the ground, and people always, at some point or another, want to put on Satan's yoke. Isn't that amazing? You realize that Judas, Jesus' disciple, for 3 years when he was with Jesus did him no harm. But one night with Satan, having entered into his heart, drove him to suicide. Because Satan whispered in his ear after he did his deed, there's no hope. It's hopeless. There's no redemption. And Judas believed it, and he took his life. Think about the power of that concept there, or that person, the effect that Satan had on him, and what Jesus offers instead. Learn from me, Jesus says, because I am gentle and humble in heart, and you and I can do well to learn from someone like that, and I will give you rest. Now, that's a conditional statement. If you learn from Jesus, if you are gentle with others like he is, if you are humble toward God like he is, if you do these things, then you will have rest for your souls. Because now you will be on the path of righteousness. But it is also true that if you will not do those things, then you will not be on that path and you will not experience the rest that he promises you. So it's, as you see on the screen here, it's a conditional promise, but it's a promise nonetheless. It's still a promise, but it requires your consent. And it doesn't matter how you feel otherwise. It doesn't matter that, well, I know it says that, but when people start talking like that to me, I start shaking my head inside and going, you don't understand. This gospel is not something that you look at and read and go, this is what it means to me personally. Because it really doesn't matter what it means to you personally. It matters what you do and what you believe personally, not how you feel about it. This is what matters, that you listen to what God says, that you do what God says, and you live like God says to live. That's what matters. How do you feel about that? That's not really relevant. Hopefully you'll feel wonderful about that once you start doing it, right? But it's really not important how you feel about that up front. It matters what needs to be done. Your soul is in jeopardy. You need to go to the Savior. Matthew chapter 9, verse 36. Here's an idea of what Jesus says about people who are in distress. Seeing the people, it says, he felt compassion for them because they were distressed and dispirited, like sheep without a shepherd, going their own way, not knowing which direction to take, always going the wrong direction, being dispersed abroad and being dispersed to every direction that is wrong. There's lots of ways to go wrong. Maybe you've noticed that. Jesus doesn't look upon our miserable conditions with scorn and hatred and scowling and contempt. He sees us as sheep who are going astray, and he has compassion for us. That doesn't mean, of course, that he overlooks all our faults and mistakes and our presumptions and just says, don't worry about that. It's water under the bridge. It doesn't mean that. But it does mean that he has compassion for you and he cares about you. And when I say you, I don't mean the generic editorial you, like you all, okay? I mean you, personally, whoever you are, he has compassion for you. He wants you to do what's right. In 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 25, for you are continually straying like sheep, but now you have returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls. That speaks of a person who is now on that path of righteousness. This is talking about a Christian who is not only a Christian in name, but he is a Christian in his heart and a Christian in his life. Jesus' role is to oversee the spiritual welfare of that person to make them whole. Because that's what he's after, is wholeness. And he does all this for his name's sake. Back to Psalm 23, verse 3. In other words, God cares about us because of his name, the investment that he's made in us as well. He made you in his image. He imparted life to you that you didn't get from your parents or just biologically, okay? He gave you something. And if you're a Christian, then he gave you his spirit in order so that you might live. That's what he's given to you. And that's summed up, at least in part, in Psalm 31. We're just reading verse 1 through 3 here, where it says, in you, O Lord, and that word Lord there is literally in the text, Jehovah, I have taken refuge. Let me never be ashamed. In your righteousness, deliver me. Incline your ear to me. Rescue me quickly. Be to me a rock of strength, a stronghold to save me. For you are my rock and my fortress. For your name's sake, you will lead me and guide me. That's powerful. And it goes along exactly with what David wrote in Psalm 23, verse 3. The benefit of your association with God as a provision of his covenant with you is it allows him to act on your behalf. It allows him to do for you what he couldn't have done for you when you were resisting him and outside of his flock, or when you're even now perhaps shaking your fist at him in defiance, if that describes you. Can't do things for you that he could do for you if you're in fellowship with him. Jesus' name is glorified through the perseverance, the triumph, and the victory of his sheep. He wants your success. He wants our success. Conversely, those who habitually dishonor the shepherd lose all such privileges. They lose that fellowship, and they lose that refreshment of their souls. So, where are you at this morning? What is the shape of your situation? What's the condition of your soul? Do you need to be restored? Have you wandered and drifted from the flock? Have you lost sight of the paths of righteousness? Whose yoke are you wearing? Is it yours? Someone else's? Some family member? Some friend? Some mentor? Some philosophy? Some person in history that you thought would save you? Did you allow someone else to put their yoke on you? You realize that all these yokes will fail you. Do you believe that your soul, your life, your whole being is safe within the oversight and the guardianship of Christ? Do you believe that He's capable of doing that? Are you concerned enough about your soul to act this morning, if necessary, to reconcile your soul, to find restoration for your soul? Or are you going to be like Felix and others who said, go away for the present, and when I find time, I'll summon you? I'm just too busy right now, or I just don't want to deal with it right now. Where are you at this morning? God has laid all His cards on the table, so to speak. He's told you exactly what He wants. He told you exactly His objective, and He's told you how He's going to reach it for you. All He needs, though, is your consent. And not just your little bit of consent. He needs your full surrender to Him. But with that, He can do great things. I hope that you believe that. I hope that you will come forward this morning if you need to, for your own soul's sake. If you're ready to be baptized into Christ and become a Christian, or if you've been a Christian and you haven't been living like you should, and you need to do something about that, come forward if you need to as we stand and sing the song that's been selected for us.